Bud asked, "Did you have any dreams that night?"
"Don't remember," Annie said.
"You said that it had been a restless night because of dreams?"
"Let me think.
I don't think Whitley was there very much. He was gone. You know, he goes sometimes at night. He goes and works.
Or he just goes."
"You have an impression of Whit being away from the bed?"
"Yes."
"Was it after he said the roof's on fire?"
"I think it was before, too.
He was just doing things all night."
"Did you hear your son?"
"Yes, he sounded so frightened. He gets nightmares sometimes, but he sounded especially frightened, more frightened than usual."
Did he say words?"
"Well, he did, but I don't remember what they were. Something really scared him. I thought somebody was doing something to him."
"Why didn't you go to him?"
"Because Whitley was already on his way.
But I remember feeling very uneasy. I wanted to go too, but I
felt I shouldn't."
"Why not?"
"I thought there was something Whitley would... It had to do with him. He was supposed to go."
"He was supposed to go?"
"Yeah, he was supposed to go."
"Oh, it must have been difficult staying in bed."
"It was, because I wondered what had happened."
"Was there something going on in the room, or did Jacques and Annie..."
"No, they weren't in on it. There was something going on. I wanted to know what was going on. There were lots of things going on, and I couldn't figure out what was going on."
"Why didn't you get up and go see?"
"I couldn't, because I wouldn't. I was afraid to, or I wasn't supposed to. It was like your mother said to you, 'You have to stay here. Even if you don't, you're dying to get out and go and see what's going on, but you know because you've been told.'"
"Who told you that?"
"Nobody told me. I just had to do it."
"Have an impulse to turn on the light?"
"Oh, no. I wasn't supposed to see."
"Anne, I want you to do me a favor," Bud said. "I want you to have a little dream, a fantasy, about what all that activity was.
What's happening?"
"Whitley's supposed to go. They came for Whitley."
"I'm sorry?"
"They came for Whitley, and he's supposed to go. But I'm not supposed to go."
"Who came?"
"Nobody that I know of. He just has a feeling that he's supposed to."
"What was restraining you from going to your son?"
"Oh, I didn't feel restrained.
I just felt like I wasn't supposed to go."
"What about the bang?"
"Maybe that's why it seemed so active that night. Maybe it was noisy."
"What kind of noises?"
"Just our son.
I get the impression..."
"It wasn't a quiet night."
"I get the impression that someone was there, but it wasn't Jacques and Annie, because they were in their room and they stayed in their room, but..."
"And then I remember Annie comforting our boy."
It was a woman. I thought it was Annie."
"It was Annie."
You recognized her voice?"
"I think I did."
"But I get the vague impression that they were in there like a cocoon, locked in that room."
"Jacques and Annie?"
"Yeah.
It's like they couldn't get out, you know."
"I want you to jump ahead to December the 26th of 1985. What you remember of that day as you concentrate very hard?"
"I remember the owl.
I remember Whitley talking about a crystal, too."
"About a what?"
"A crystal in the sky."
"But that was before the owl."
"Did you see it?"
"Oh, no."
"Why do you say, oh, no, as if..."
"Oh, Whitley saw a lot of things that I didn't see at that time."
"Did you look for it?"
"Oh, no, because I knew it wasn't real."
"How did you know it wasn't real?"
"Whitley's a fairly down-to-earth guy."
"No, he isn't."
"He's not?"
"No."
"Because there couldn't be a crystal in the sky."
"You think Whitley should go to a psychiatrist?"
"No."
"Because he..."
"Well, I think he can deal with these problems."
"Back to that night. It was so restless. It was like a party. It was like a party and not being invited.
What kind of party was it?
Well, you know. Jacques and Annie weren't invited either. It was all going on downstairs, and I had to wait for them to come back. It was like your mother says, no, you can't go.
Do you think that feeling may have ever happened to you before?
Well, I've often felt that there are things going on with Whitley that I wasn't supposed to know. I'm supposed to kind of help him afterwards deal with it. That's my role. But I can't stop them, you know. He just has to.
Do you think that these are things that come out of Whitley's head?
No. I don't think he has hallucinations, no. But I think they come to him because of his head. He has a very unique head.
Annie, I'd like to ask you, there was a night on LaGuardia Place that something thumped you?
Oh, the white thing.
You have a sense of what that was?
Oh, yes. Like a sharp jab in the stomach.
It was like four fingers, not just one finger. It was like a joke. But then who would do that? And once, and disappear, you know, woke me right up.
Did you open your eyes?
No, I don't think so, but I sat up. It woke me up. My son woke up and had a nightmare at the same time and said something poked him in the stomach. And then Whitley, he said something poked him in the stomach. He said he saw a little white thing.
I listened to the recording of Anne's first hypnosis on March 17, 1986, the Monday after the confirming encounter in the country. I asked her, what do you mean Whitley's supposed to go?
Well, that's what I said.
Do you see me go?
No, but I hear it. There's a lot of noise sometimes. I keep my eyes closed.
But don't you worry.
No.
You're always there in the morning.
Anne's testimony had a powerful effect on me. Hers was probably the most remarkable element yet to be introduced into this account. This was because there seemed to be so much unconscious process implied by her testimony. It really did appear that she had performed a function she had been trained to do. And there was that enigmatic female presence. In my own hypnosis, I remembered it making some sort of noises to me when it was beside the bed on the night of October 4th. I was disappearing into the night. I had remembered probes going into my brain. My wife had painted a picture of me as a sort of soldier of the night, vulnerable and helpless. One could state a few things with certainty, if one was careful. Something had happened to me, and possibly to my son. Its source and nature were unknown, but there was a strong suggestion that it included some sort of physical component external to and independent of us. Another thing that could be stated was that my wife had been aware that something was happening, and she responded by preserving her own neutrality. Maybe she had been trained to do this, and maybe not. It could also be that she was doing it out of an instinct to help her husband. The support she had provided may have been her own invention, rather than the outcome of training or suggestion from the visitors. While Anne's hidden role seemed to be that of passive supporter, her own life role is very different. It was clearly revealed by a statement she made before the second session, when Dr. Nyman asked her if her presence in his office was voluntary. If I had said, no, I'm not going through with this, I wouldn't be here. She is as independent a person as I know, a committed feminist who is politically and socially as active as she cares to be. Except when it comes to this. In this matter, she is passive, which is in itself awfully strange. As the intensity of the experience built, Anne became uneasy with her role. Things were going on, and I wanted to know what was going on. Her tone became forceful, almost angry. When asked why she didn't simply go and see, she repeated that she wasn't supposed to.
Supporting this came the first of a number of what she feels are references to a female authority. It was like your mother said to you, you have to stay here. Anne's hypnosis strongly suggested that I'm taken all the time. When she was being hypnotized, Anne had no idea at all that I remembered more than two occasions when something strange happened. She said frankly that she did not consider me a down-to-earth guy. I'm glad of that. After all that appears to have been happening, she would have to be incredibly imperceptive to think that I was down-to-earth. Dr. Nyman quite naturally asked her if she thought I should go to a psychiatrist. Her reply was interesting. No, because I think he can deal with these problems. What? I'm seeing things, and my practical, no-nonsense wife doesn't think I should see a psychiatrist. Perhaps she knew that there would be no point, because on the level she would not directly address, she was aware that these are the side effects of real experience. I've asked my son to describe any strange dreams he recalls. He has never been hypnotized, and he won't be until he can decide for himself if he wishes to do it. No matter what the source, this material can be very disturbing indeed under hypnosis, and it is certainly not the business of a parent to assault a child's mind by such experimentation. Here are some of my son's dreams in his own words. Well, I was dreaming that I was on a boat with my friend Ezra, and we were about to dive off, and I was in the middle of the air when I switched to this dream where I was in the hospital in the future, where they were trying to cure some kind of disease. And I was taken out of my bed and onto a cot and out on the porch. Who took you out of your bed onto the cot? Some kind of doctor. What did he look like? Oh, he was a very short and fat man with glasses that came out pointed upward. And he always has a big fake smile on him. Did you see him when he wasn't smiling? Yeah. Well, when he was doing the operation on me. What kind of operation? It was a disease on my arm. He did something to your arm? No, wait. He kept your nose cold like when you eat a lot of ice cream. You say you were examined on the porch. What do you mean by that? Well, they took me out onto the porch. There was no way to get me into an operation room because of all the moving equipment. They took special lights and examined my nose and took x-rays and stuff. Ever remember a dream where a monster came in the house and Mommy fainted? What's that from? Oh, that's one of my journal stories. Yeah? Why'd you make that one up for your journal? I don't know. It was a free journal story period, and I couldn't think of anything. I was tossing and turning in my desk trying to think of something, and then suddenly that dream just popped into my head. What was it like, that dream? It was in a cornfield, my mommy and me, and I was chewing on this piece of corn, and my mom was telling fairy tales. And then suddenly this big, let's say from the lobby of this building up to the top, hovered over us. It was colored orange, green, had blue feet. Do you suppose you were seeing something flying over you that was blue and orange and green, and you were confused as to what it was? It was like it was flying, kind of. At this point, I felt I had made a mistake with my last question. It was so heavily weighted with suggestion. I sat in my chair, haunted by what my son had said. I will relate a dream I had had shortly before we spoke. The three of us were together in an English countryside in my dream. We had rented a cottage. Inside of the cottage was identical to our cabin. I was confused because Anne and our son were not there, and it was already evening. I was sitting up in bed when I got a call on the phone. I remember saying to the caller, "No, it's all right. They're just staying out all night." On some level, I was full of fear, but on another, I seemed to have accepted their disappearance by justifying it to myself. In the middle of the night, there was a knock at the front door. I opened it to find my son in the company of a group of rescue workers, ordinary men and women with deep, soft, and loving faces. My son was naked except for a dark blue cap that one of them had put on his head. He was moving strangely, as if he had no control over his muscles. His eyes looked as if he were in some sort of trance. I gathered him up in my arms because they told me that touch and hugging would bring him back to normal. Then I looked around for my wife. They shook their heads sadly, and the care and love radiating from their eyes was such that I was not bereaved but reassured that she would be back soon. Then I was abruptly transported to another place. I was given to understand that Anne and our son had been found here, hiding. It was a cornfield, just like our son's dream. At bedtime that night, he wanted to talk more about his dreams. I did not record our conversation, but he complained of two things. The first was that when he started to go to sleep, his whole body would tingle, and he would feel as if his hair were standing on end. A voice would then ask him about his day, how he felt, and private things, which he did not wish to discuss with me. He also complained that he saw a skeleton looking at him when he was trying to relax. The conversation went as follows. A skeleton? Yes. And it keeps staring at me like it was right in front of my face and it won't go away. What does it look like? Well, it's not a skeleton. It's one of the thin ones that stood around behind the doctors. What thin ones? You know. The thin ones that are always saying, we won't hurt you, them. It's not a skeleton, it's one of the thin ones. The appearance of these people has never been discussed with my son at all, not by anybody, and yet his description of short ones and taller thin ones is not only consistent with my own observations, it is consistent with the experiences of many of the other people who have encountered the visitors. My historical survey has found that the core experience of seeing flying discs and small figures goes back a long, long time. I have spent a great deal of time in the past few months searching what could only be described as a morass of literature on the subject of unidentified entities and their craft. I have talked to scientists who think that it's all nonsense and to scientists who are not so sure. I have read dozens of case histories and have met many people who have had visitor experiences. Something is happening. This is clear. It is not a version of known phenomena. There is some small reason to speculate that the United States government may have had some sort of communication from visitors as early as the late 1940s, as well as obtained pieces of crashed discs and bodies of the occupants. I base this notion on the two best pieces of evidence I could find, both of which I have personally investigated and confirmed as genuine. These two pieces of evidence are certainly real, in the sense that they are not witting hoaxes. The first document is a letter written by Dr. Robert I. Sarbacher, dated November 29, 1983, addressed to Mr. William Steinman, a UFO researcher who has inquired about Sarbacher's government consulting activities during the late 40s. Dr. Sarbacher was a Department of Defense Research and Development Board consultant during the Eisenhower administration. Educated at Johns Hopkins, Harvard, and Princeton, he is the author of Hyper and Ultra High Frequency Engineering, Research Accrediting at Military Establishments, and the Encyclopedia Dictionary of Electronics and Engineering. Dr. Sarbacher writes in part, relating to my own experiences regarding recovered flying saucers, I had no association with any of the people involved in the recovery and have no knowledge regarding the dates of the recoveries. About the only thing I remember at this time is that certain materials reported to have come from flying saucer crashes were extremely light and very tough. I am sure our laboratories analyzed them very carefully. There were reports that instruments or people operating these machines were also a very light weight, sufficient to withstand the tremendous deceleration and acceleration associated with their machinery. I remember, in talking with some of the people at the office, that I got the impression that these aliens were constructed like certain insects we have observed on Earth. I still do not know why the high order of classification has been given, and why the denial of the existence of these devices. My hypnotic transcripts continually refer to my impression that I was dealing with creatures that moved like insects. I did not know of Dr. Sarvacker and his letter until August the 9th, 1986, months after I had my experiences. My second piece of evidence, that the government may know more about this than it is saying, is a small but telling one. A press release that was issued in July 1947. In that month, an incident took place on a ranch near Roswell, New Mexico, that is the granddaddy of all the government has UFO alien bodies rumors. Throughout 1947, there were many reports in the New Mexico newspapers of odd lights. But the first modern flying disc sighting near Mount Rainier, Washington, had been heavily publicized at the time, and some of the New Mexico sightings may have been the result of confused observations of two V-2 launches at White Sands. One took place on June 12th and another on July the 3rd. However, on the evening of July the 2nd, something was seen by members of the public in the skies over Roswell and reported locally. This object was brightly lit and crossed the skies in a northwesterly direction. On July the 8th, the Roswell Army Air Base issued a release which was published, among other places, in the San Francisco Chronicle. The release was issued by Public Relations Officer Lieutenant Walter Hout, on order from the base commander, and it read, "The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence office of the 509th Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force, Roswell Army Airfield, was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc through the cooperation of one of the local ranchers and the sheriff's office of Chavez County. The flying object landed on a ranch near Roswell sometime last week. Action was immediately taken, and the disc was picked up at the rancher's home. It was inspected at the Roswell Army Airfield and subsequently loaned by Major Jesse A. Marcel to higher headquarters. Later, a report was issued to the effect that this disc was a crushed weather balloon. Under the headline, Disc Solution Collapses, the Chronicle reported that General Roger M. Ramey had stated that the wreckage was a high-altitude weather observation device that consisted of a box kite and a balloon. Later, in the same story, General Ramey is reported to have said that it was a star-shaped tinfoil target designed to reflect radar. Since General Ramey claimed to have the debris in his office, it is strange that he could not seem to settle on an identification for it. Much has been made of the fact that the original discoverer of the device, rancher W.W. Brazel, was quoted by the Associated Press as being sorry he told about it, and describing what he found as tinfoil and other debris. There are three enormous problems with the credibility of the rancher's statements. The first is that he was held incommunicado for days before he made them. The second is that members of his family have asserted that he made them under duress, and his being held incommunicado, which is a matter of record, would certainly support that assertion. The third problem is more telling because it does not rely on the rancher's verisimilitude at all. It is that none of the officers originally involved ever thought that they were dealing with the remains of known objects, or they never would have allowed their press release to be issued in the first place. Was Mr. Brazel interrogated in order to induce him to change his story? There seems to be no other logical conclusion. The inescapable fact of the Roswell affair is that a group of professionally competent Air Force officers caused the publication of a press release claiming that the Air Force had recovered a crashed flying disc after observing the debris. Only after this release was published was any attempt made to change the story. Even then, neither the release, nor the professional competence of its author, his base commander, or the concerned intelligence officers was ever called into question. Publicly, or, as far as I was able to discern, in internal Air Force procedures. Instead, the original witness, who was in no position to know what he had actually seen, was placed under duress and compelled to change his story. It appears that there is more than a shred of evidence that there are visitors here, and that they are doing something that involves us. It is also obvious, from their secrecy, that they want very much to hide. Can it be that the government is inadvertently helping them to do this, or even that they have somehow compelled it to act as it does? Certainly, the combination of visitor and government secrecy has led to profound public confusion. We do not know what is going on. Maybe the visitor experience is what happens when the human mind looks into the mirror and discovers that its own reflection is not only real, but fearful to see. Something is here, but what? And from where? We come at last to the essence of the mystery. We do not and cannot know the actual condition of life elsewhere in the universe because we are presently too ignorant of conditions outside our own immediate solar neighborhood. However, judging from the amount of evidence available, it may be possible to expand our knowledge simply by taking the flying disc and the abductee phenomena seriously. We may or may not find visitors, but we would certainly find a body of data so compelling and multidimensional in its complexity that merely stating useful hypotheses about it is going to be a major challenge, not only to the physical and behavioral sciences, but also to the science and art of language. It is our American habit to assume that there is something irrelevant, even a little silly, about the past. Our relationship to former times is expressed as nostalgia, not history. When our government first started studying flying saucers in the late 40s, it never even occurred to anybody official to consider having a look at the past. Here are two stories. In the little town of Merkel, Texas, on April 26, 1897, a group of people going home from church at night allegedly saw a heavy object dragging along the ground. They followed it until it bounced across a railroad track and caught on one of the rails. It was an anchor, tied to a rope. When they looked up, they saw an airship with lighted windows and a headlight on the front, brighter than the light of a locomotive. 10 minutes passed, and soon a man was seen coming down the rope. He was small and wearing a blue sailor suit. When he saw the people, he cut the rope, and the ship sailed off into the night, leaving the anchor behind. The small beings I first saw were dressed in dark blue coveralls. This is not a unique description of the visitor's garb. Perhaps it is sort of a night uniform. One Sunday, in the borough of Cloreira in Ireland, the parishioners of the church of St. Canarius heard a noise on the roof. They went outside and saw an anchor embedded in the eaves. The anchor line rose up into the sky, where there floated a ship on the air. A man leaped overboard and swam down to the anchor. After an altercation with the parishioners, he cut the rope and managed to return to the ship, which sailed away. The anchor remained in the church, but has since been lost. Since this incident took place not in 1897, but around A.D. 1211. During the reign of Pepin in the early Middle Ages, the French were bothered by apparitions that were seen marching through the sky, camped out in tents on the reaches of heaven, and sometimes in wonderfully constructed aerial ships that flew past in veritable squadrons. People were annoyed at the presence of all this unquestionable grandeur and happiness. and both Charlemagne and his successor, Louis the Debonair, imposed penalties on the tyrants of the air. As counter-propaganda, the sylphs kidnapped people and took them to their airy abode, showing them their world. But when the people were sent home, they were all burned at the stake without a second's hesitation. My point is that there may be far more to this than science or government or even religion can separately address. It would seem that our civilization is not paying attention to what may be the central archetypal and mythological experience of our age. If so, then this is the first time that man has simply refused to respond to the ghosts and the gods. Is that why they have become so physical, so real, dragging people out of bed like rapists in the night? Because they must have our notice in order to somehow be confirmed in their own truth. This may be primarily a matter of visions and chimeras, battering at the door of physical reality. They are not simply flickering effects of the mind. Something is out there and wants in. Whomever and whatever the visitors are, their activities go far beyond a mere study of mankind. They are involved with us on very deep levels, playing in the band of dream, weaving imagination and reality together until they begin to seem what they probably are, different aspects of a single continuum. To really begin to perceive the visitors adequately, it is going to be necessary to invent a new discipline of vision, one that combines the mystic's freedom of imagination with the substantial intellectual rigor of the scientist. Maybe there really is another species living upon this earth, the fairies, the gnomes, the sylphs, vampires, goblins, who attach to reality along a different line than we do, but who know and love us, as we do the wild things of the woods, who, perhaps, are trying to save us from ourselves, or whose lives are inextricably linked to our own. If we die, must the gods, the fairies, the elves then fall into some blue glen of unknowing? Will their secret world go cold without us, or will there only be less excitement? The visitors often appear in threes. They project triangular lights. They have been reported to wear various types of triangular devices and emblems. People see three pyramids or three triangles in connection with them. A huge triangular-shaped object is sometimes sighted. I had triangles etched on my arm. In order to approach an initial understanding of the visitor experience, if that is possible, it might be productive to explore the inner meaning of the triangular shape. There are many ancient traditions that view man as being with three parts, body, mind, and heart. It seems possible that the visitors view themselves as an entire species with three parts, judging from the three distinct basic forms that have been seen. The fundamental idea of the triad as a creative energy is that two opposite forces coming into balance create a third force. The idea of the triad is not static. It is an expression of a series of emanations. The third force emerges when the first and second forces come into balance. And when all three are in harmony, they become a fourth thing, an indivisible whole. When we were first married, Anne and I found a motto for ourselves in the Bible, from Ecclesiastes. Two are better than one, and a cord of three strands is not quickly snapped. Anne cross-stitched it, and it has been with us ever since. The third strand is the love, then the child, then the long unraveling of the years. At last, it is what is left of a lifetime spent together, the fading remembrance, the generations to come, and also the joy that ripens in souls. For there to be a growth instead of death, Much more must be brought to the triad than mere conquest or contact, which, if the visitors are as advanced as they seem, would amount to a form of conquest. Communion is as wide as all the knowledge of both partners, as deep as their whole souls. Marriage requires patience, giving without thought to keep accounts. When one says, "I gave this, and so I am owed that," the marriage has not yet begun. Real sharing rests in a balanced recognition of sameness and difference. It is a discovery of balances and equalities. We need to give ourselves to our experience without knowing what it is, trusting that our understanding will grow as we proceed. To participate truly in this experience, we must marry the unknown. The only belief is the question itself. Love is a matter of leaping out into the sky. We do not even know if there are visitors. We do not know what we are, why this is happening, or exactly what is happening. The real center of the experience lies not in some facile explanation. It lies in opening oneself to the question as it really exists, with all its mystery and danger. Our agony is to stand before the utter blackness of the unknown with full knowledge that there is something there. And it is alive, and if one is to remain on the path of inner search, one must trust it, even though it may very certainly be dangerous. Strength is needed to endure the fire, courage to enter it, intelligence to come out alive. I do not have it in me to be a believer, nor can I be a true skeptic, for I loathe the narrow and love the broad. I cannot say in all truth that I am certain the visitors are present as entities entirely independent of their observers, nor can I say I do not think they are here at all. It is not enough for us to ascribe the visitor experience to some unusual manifestation of known phenomena and then ignore it. Science has not explained the visitors. Indeed, it has not even begun to explore them. Nor is it sufficient to say that higher beings are studying us and remain passively waiting for what titbits of knowledge they may toss us. The visitor experience drives us to extremes. Those who have seen the devices or their occupants are often convinced that they are extraterrestrial in origin, and science debunks that, just as the clergy debunk the fairies in centuries past, and for the same reason. These outrageous enigmatics so threaten the established order of belief that they must at all costs be rejected. There was no room in 17th century Christian theology for fairies, and there is scarcely more in 20th century scientific theory of visitors as peculiar as these. But the difference between science and theology is that science can make room for new things. Looking back over my experience with the visitors, I cannot say that I felt inferior to them. On the contrary, the people I encountered did not seem superior so much as wiser, but also more simple and unformed as individuals. And they not only feared me, they seemed in awe of me. They are not all-powerful super beings. They are frail, limited individuals, far from home. If indeed this world is not their home. I can discern a visible agenda of contact in what is happening. Over the past 40 or so years, their involvement with us has not only been deepening, it has been spreading rapidly through the society. At least, this is how things appear. The truth may be that it is not their involvement that is increasing, but our perception that is becoming sharper. The evolution of this increase in perception may have a very definite design. We initially noticed objects from afar, then closer, Then we remembered seeing the visitors, and now we are beginning to remember being with them. Will the visitors emerge into our world on a flood of memory? And if so, then why? Look, why not simply land, open the hatch, and come out? It could be that they wish to avoid what Cortez did with such eagerness. It is not difficult to crush the flower of a culture's spontaneity. Would we not all risk being lost in non-meaning if an apparently superior visitor culture emerged suddenly into the open? Science, religion, even the arts might be shattered by the appearance of a culture that already knew everything we want to know about the universe. Unless, of course, it were to emerge not into blinded awe, but into our understanding of its truth, its strengths, as well as its weaknesses. I would not be at all surprised if the visitors are real and are slowly coming into contact with us according to an agenda of their own devising, which proceeds as human understanding increases. If they are not from our universe, it could be necessary for us to understand them before they can emerge into our reality. In our universe, their reality may depend on our belief. Thus, the corridor into our world could, in a very true sense, be through our own minds. This is not a mere matter to be explained away by one facile dodge or another. It is an immense human reality, vast in its impact and complexity. It has coherence, strange but undeniable, and thus there is certainly a process of thought that will draw it into our understanding. Presently, it is lacking effective definition. To leave it this way, when it seems so rich with potential, would be a shame. But has science the wit to study such an elusive and multidimensional enigma? I say yes, resoundingly so. Even a brilliant but arrogant curmudgeon of my acquaintance, who denounced it all as preposterous, is important to an understanding of it. Blind denial is as empty a response as blind acceptance, and operates on the same level of validity. There is no real intellectual difference between the haughty psychiatrist or physicist and his refusal to accept the truth, and the nervous contactee eager to see the phenomenon as a dimensionless cartoon of space friends. We must break through both distortions, and we certainly can. The visitor experience may be our first true quantum discovery in the large-scale world. The very act of observing it may be creating it as a concrete actuality with sense, definition, and a consciousness of its own. And perhaps, in their world, the visitors are working as hard to create us. Truly, such an act of mutual insight and courage would be communion. Two universes spinning each other together. The old weaver of reality rethreading creation's loom. Something is here. Be it a message from the stars, or from the booming labyrinth of the mind, or from both. It must have left a signature somewhere, a thread in the snow, the scratch of a strange nail upon a wall. And we can certainly find that thread if we bring humor and honesty and courage and great care to the effort. In taking the thread, we might find ourselves in possession of a very real key to the universe. Once the thread is in hand, our own mythology will tell us where it leads, for it will be the same thread that the maiden Ariadne handed to Theseus when he stood before the maze of the Minotaur, young and strong and mad with courage. And we will all go down the labyrinth to meet whatever awaits us there.